The 82-game preseason is in the books, and it's finally time for the real season. Don't miss out on any of the NBA playoff action at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. From the play-in tournament through the finals, DraftKings Sportsbook has you covered. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code SMASH. New customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. That's code SMASH, only on DraftKings. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or in West Virginia. Visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas, 21 and over, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.co/bball for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources.
Hi, this is Jim.
And this is Max.
Check out our podcast, The Step Over, the Liberty Ballers Podcast Network, for all of your Sixers needs.
Player analysis, game breakdowns, who would look coolest in a headband, and more.
Subscribe to Liberty Ballers Podcast feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and check out The Step Over, a podcast about Sixers basketball.
Mostly.
Michael Kist, Benjamin Solak. It's the Kist and Solak Show, presented by SB Nation and Bleeding Green Nation.
You are flying high on the Kist and Solak Show. This is episode 7, brought to you by RPO Nation and RPO Green Nation and... you can follow me at RPO Michael Kist, NFL.
This episode sponsored by yellow flags, yellow clothes, yellow everything that's yellow or a flag. Ideally, yellow flags. Just the intersection of the Venn diagram. This episode is brought to you by flags.
This episode is brought to you by Red Zone Incompetence. Brought to you by the Atlanta Falcons. Again, Michael Kist, your host. Best doggone co-host in the game with me, Benjamin Solak. We're recording right after the game. Follow Benjamin at Benjamin Solak. That's S-O-L-A-K, Ben. This was a wild game, and I could talk about this game for conservatively 17 hours. I just want to say that when I led off the show, the preview show with you, and ranted about the red zone offense for the Atlanta Falcons for conservatively 5 minutes, when your boy is right, your boy is right, because that was bad.
Mad respect. That was after the first drive where they got stuffed on 4th and 1, I said, listen, obviously, you know, Julio didn't necessarily get the targets that Julio probably deserves down there, but I really like the 3rd down play call. Obviously, yeah, coming out in 23 personnel is a little aggressive, but then you motion out to a 3-receiver sort of a set and you get Devonta Freeman on Nate Gary. That's a great situation. That's a good play call. Poor execution. Should have been 6. So after that first red zone drive, I was defending Sark. I was like, listen, that wasn't too bad. Then they got all the way back to the 5. Or no, wait, that was the last drive. They got all the way back to the 15 later. Yeah. No points. They got all the way back to the 5. No points. How? That's unbelievably ineffective. Like, you have to try intentionally hard to not score points when you're that close to the end zone. That's amazing.
Defenses give up go look up red zone percentages for touchdowns in the red just for the league. You have to be totally incompetent. And then in the second drive, so then the first drive, they take Julio out on 3rd and 4th down and they go jumbo set, which was crazy. And then 3rd down, they miss Devonta Freeman. And then 4th down, they do that toss where they try to jam 11 people versus 11 people into one small space. And of course, there's no space to work with. Kamu Grugier-Hill did a great job on the edge there, setting his edge. The play was strung out by everybody else and he was there for the tackle. Then the second time, they get in the red zone early in the game. And they come out in bunch, and they've got Julio on the outside. I'm like, oh, they're going to run some intersecting type route and try to free up Julio because there's going to be some attention on him. Eagles are running man, probably running like banjo switch where they can pass off routes. And they just run a speed out with him to a cornerback that already has outside leverage that's going to man him up anyway. Like, it was a total waste of Julio there. Then, of course, final score 18-12, Eagles win. Now, that's the most important thing. And how it comes about is... the Falcons get into the red zone again. And Ben, did you notice They were running Julio from the three, right? So you're counting wide receivers, yeah. One on the outside, two inside of that, three inside of that. Julio is in the three. They're bracket coveraging him inside, outside. They try to run that route to him straight up the seam. They try to throw it to him twice. How unimaginative and how vanilla and stupid can you be knowing you're going to get the double there and you don't try to free him up whatsoever? And then what? A fade? A 50-50? How? Yeah, they were in a little intersecting type deal where on the release he switched with Sanu, but it was the most uninspired play calling. And in the first half, after the half, they said, oh, you know, we got some more packages that we're going to run in the red zone this half. Where were they? What were they?
They were high school packages. Listen, I don't hate the fourth and goal fade. To me, and this is just law of numbers at this point, I have Julio Jones on either Ronald Darby or Jalen Mills. I probably put him to the right side of the formation to get him on Mills. I run the fade at least three times. Is it a high percentage play? No. Is it better than anything else I have right now available to me? Yes, because none of my other plays are working well. I've been very ineffective in the red zone, so might as well get back to basics. And point C, it's Julio.
Yeah.
Maybe it's point two. I don't remember. It's Julio Jones. Listen, but
You can either blame the coaching leading up to that with the double teams, or you can blame the execution because he was out of bounds anyway. Either Matt Ryan let him out of bounds or Julio ran his route too wide. Right. Like, it was just bad.
Yeah, that fourth down play, Julio gave up so much space. He elevated backwards. He did not elevate vertically, right? And so he was already putting himself in a bad situation from the jump. But hey, move him a little closer into the formation and run it again. Oh, wait, it's fourth and goal. You have to do this. And what's so sad, here's what's just painfully sad to me. Their touchdown was on an inside zone run inside the 10. It's just the easiest, the most basic, like, day one install run. What I want to do is sit down with Sark and be like, tell me what your team's good at. Like, what is your offense good at? Do that. You're rarely, if ever, putting Julio as the innermost slot anywhere except for the red zone. You do it a little bit on third down situations, but really they don't do it that much. So what are you doing here right now? Yeah, this is not necessary. I think they came out with that fullback constantly in that first drive and then got super skittish of that in the red zone, where really that's the one spot you should maybe actually be using a freaking fullback. Yeah. Oh man. It's like, it's at the point where, because like Sark knows that that's a problem and the Atlanta Falcons offense knows that it's a problem.
It's
just become a self-perpetuating circle. It's just become a vicious spiral where like they just outthink themselves and they outdo themselves. And obviously revisionist history is so easy, right? It's effortless for us to be able to say, oh, this is a bad decision or whatever. But I really think they're in a bad spot with it. I will say that fourth and goal fade never should have happened, because of all the penalties and missed calls and non-calls, which are, like, you know, we do our best on this particular show not to really discuss them that much. Man, calling illegal contact on the goal line is something.
For that, yeah.
Yeah, it's not in the rule book that, like, oh, like, this rule gets lessened in the end zone. But the reality is, like, defenders are going to get connected to receivers in the end zone because it's the end zone and there's nowhere else to go. Like, you can't go, you're not trying to get downfield. There's no more downfield, guys.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Not only that, we saw, and look, I thought Devondre Campbell, the linebacker for the Atlanta Falcons, did a fantastic job in coverage, and it's a big advantage for the Falcons when you have linebackers that can match up with Zach Ertz, and Duke Riley matched up with Dallas Goedert, had great coverage him on the vertical seam. But we saw just as physical coverage at the top of the route by Devondre Campbell on Zach Ertz, and I called it great coverage. And you know what? Jordan Hicks is at the top of the route, and if the tight end wants to come in and they both initiate contact, let it go. There were so many soft calls on both sides. And I'm not, again, I hate blaming referees for anything. Yeah. I just thought this game was played just called real soft. Too many flags.
Let me tell you who I'm going to murder. You want to know who I'm going to murder? I'm going to make a tradition for the 2018 season where I choose one person to murder after every game.
Is this a player or is it like an ancillary?
It's anybody I want it to be. Trust me. Chris Collinsworth, very high up on the list as far as potential murder guys. Everybody already knows I don't like Chris.
I'm going to go with Al Michaels because he said that the Atlanta Falcons ran an RPO on 2nd and 25 and literally everyone was pass blocking. It was the most ridiculous thing.
Yo, Michaels puts so much like unnecessary accent on names that are like not natively English, like Nelson Aguilar, Ajayi, Mohamed Sanu. Like, he's like throws all this like pizzazz on it. That's like a little uncomfortable for me. It's so bad. No, Michaels having a rough game. Michael's clearly felt marginalized by Chris Collinsworth's liberal usage of RPO. He wanted to kind of snag some of the thunder. And so he started using it all the time.
For everything. Oh, my God.
Like, before, you'd see Ryan, like, fake the handoff, pull the ball, and Miles be like, ah, that's an RPO. Like, we haven't even seen the rest of the play yet, Chief. Like, we don't really know what's going on. But no, my my murder for the game is Trey Sullivan, man. I was furious.
Oh, I you know what? Let's talk about this, because I want to talk about some turning points in the game, and that, for me, was a big turning point, and it's probably
that
yours.
Was
bad.
Huge. Like, if the Eagles lost this game, we'd be looking back at that just being like, you dunce. Because and I went through the rule book trying to figure out if
you could be thrown onto a loose ball, because he was around six guys that threw him onto that thing.
Yeah,
but he can't be in that situation,
right? So you definitely can't be like thrown into a loose ball. That being said, Sullivan, while he was being dragged, obviously was actively engaging with the opponent and was clearly like trying to generate some displacement. What are you doing, buddy? Like, ah, that's sort of like in a slop fest game like this, where the slightest error is getting called or is causing problems, to make that egregious of a mistake. Like, what game have you been watching, man? You have your head about you here. Oh, man, that was something terrible.
There were three plays back to back to back, it felt like, that really just took the momentum away from the Eagles after their go-ahead touchdown in the red zone. By the way, I want to talk about this real quick, and we're going to talk about these turning points. A turning point was that go-ahead touchdown by Jay Ajayi in the red zone. Ball on the one-yard line. You get a seven-man box because you go three wide. You get jet motion, and not only do you have a defensive back trailing the jet motion man, but the jet motion man blocks Vic Beasley, gets in his way. So not only are you taking two guys out of the play, you're also blocking a bigger man with a smaller man, because all he has to do is get in the way, because it's a quick hitting run up the middle. And you're not trying to jam 11 guys against 11 guys. Like, that to me is red zone play calling.
I really liked that play call from a individual player standpoint, because who had just been like the go-to as far as like short yardage quick games all game had been Aguilar. It's just been constantly we're finding him in the shorts, we're getting him involved, oh, a little reverse, oh, a little like, you know, screen action, whatever, da 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 da. That, see that 13 coming across the formation's big eye candy, and oftentimes what you expect from Philadelphia in terms of jet motion is for him to clear that edge, clear the edge, and then it looks like a little quick screen or he's flaring out or something. But this snap came about, I would say, a second earlier than you would anticipate as a defender with what you've seen off that jet motion. So you get good push off the line right at the snap. And then, yeah, like you said, Aguilar just runs full head of steam into a pretty much stationary Beasley. All he's got to do is just be in his way for a small period of time, and you've got good daylight for Ajayi. I was impressed with Ajayi. He did what I anticipated him to do to a smaller defense in Atlanta. He didn't get much involved in the first quarter. Apparently, he was gimpy a little bit. It was like feeling out his foot on the sideline. But the Eagles' offensive line came out much stronger in that second half, Mike. They were struggling to generate good displacement up front in the first half. I thought Atlanta's front four was doing a really good job, and this was a good note by Collinsworth. They were switching gaps. They were playing really fundamentally sound football with their linebackers, allowing their linebackers to flow very hard to the front. Philadelphia's offensive line turned up the physicality in the second half, which is surprising. Yeah. Usually the defensive line, fresher in the second half, starts to find an advantage. You saw that with Philadelphia. Eagles' offensive line stepped up in a big way. So ups for conditioning, up for Jeff Stoutland. They did, thank goodness, incorporate some more off-tackle runs in the second half. Shout out to Ajayi's touchdown run, which was a little pin pull outside zone, which is not your traditional outside zone, but it's what they needed to hit, because you saw Deion Jones come flying downhill and then just get eaten alive by Kelsey, because he's got to take a much flatter angle on that, and he didn't. He came downhill, because that's what he'd been doing all game, and they were able to catch an edge on him. So very nice situational play calling when it mattered the most, for sure.
So after one quarter of one net yard and a bad first half for the offense, they come out in the second half, they're able to run the ball more. That leads to the touchdown of which we spoke with Jay Ajayi. They go up 10-6, and then you get the punt where Trey Sullivan touches the ball. That changes things. The defense gets a stop with Derek Barnett being offsides for the second time in a key situation in that game.
I would like to say, just like as a note, I probably tweet a lot during games. I probably tweet a lot of analysis during games. I apologize for that. But I saw Barnett offsides. I saw him. But I know because my stream is behind the regular game, I can't get that tweet out fast enough before the penalty. But I would like for it to be known that I saw he was offside. I was screaming at him and he didn't get back. And when I saw that flag, I was so pissed.
Yeah, big penalties for him. And we talked about his snap anticipation being off early in games. It was off again in a situation in the first quarter. And then he was lined up offsides in that situation. And then guess who bails us out? Rasul Douglas. And here's what's interesting to me about that interception. You've got Rasul Douglas again and Sidney Jones. And you've got Julio Jones. And I think it may have been Sanu. It doesn't matter. Either way, one of those two guys, one's going to take outside. One's going to take inside. If Julio goes inside, he gets Sidney Jones. If Julio Jones goes outside, which he did, he gets Rasul Douglas. Jim Schwartz trusted Rasul Douglas and Sidney Jones, two second-year guys. And Sidney Jones is basically a redshirt, and they rewarded him.
Yeah, listen, in camp, when they were working goal line, it became very clear that the ability to banjo, the ability to just play outside, inside, and not track man, is up to the corners when they're in that stack. They communicate and they decide what they want to do in man coverage. And I know for a fact, because he told me, Sewell loves to get the banjo call. He wants it every time. Because what does that allow him to do? It allows him to play with his eyes in the backfield and not have to turn his hips immediately. And Sewell likes to do that because Sewell likes to attack the football. Now, obviously, he had to turn his hips to run with Julio once he went down the field. But I can promise you, like, having spent a good deal of time talking with Rasul Douglas, who's the man and is hysterical, that they're like he wanted that switch on Julio so, so, so badly. He wanted Julio to come outside so badly. And he was, I can't imagine how lit he was after that pick.
And then Matt Ryan, who, I don't know, his arm strength didn't look fantastic to me in this game.
What happened?
Popped an arm. He was underthrowing everything.
I want to go back and see if he got hit in the first quarter and like landed on his arm funny or something.
Okay. So I'm not crazy because I thought it looked bad.
That's the only thing I can think of. Because I have never seen Ryan, who is a quarterback that I like a lot, look just that bad. That was one of the worst performances I have seen from Matt Ryan ever, hands down.
So you get the interception from Rasul Douglas. The defense bails the team out once again. At that point, 4 red zone trips, 6 points for the Atlanta Falcons. That's balling out for that defense. I don't care how incompetent the Atlanta Falcons were from a play calling standpoint, from an execution standpoint. A defense taking a stand like that is more than just the offense. They did very, very well in that situation, and hats off to them. The problem is, fourth quarter, when it looks like momentum is going their way, they've got the lead 10-6. They get the interception in the red zone. They get bailed out again. The offense gets the ball. They convert a key third down with Nelson Aguilar on that nice little toss play, which is beautiful. You're like, oh, everything's clicking right now. This game is, I thought the game was in the bag. I'm like, this thing is, now we're rolling. Now we've got the confidence, got the momentum. Momentum for me is a real thing. And I think we were rolling with it. And then Dallas Goedert takes a hit from DeMonte Casey, who is filling in for Keanu Neal, who, by the way, wow, that would be a big loss for the Atlanta Falcons if he has a serious knee injury, because he was knocked, came back, and that did not look good when he went down. Dallas Goedert takes a hit. Casey knocks it up, and Deion Jones gets the interception, and that's when the defense finally gave one up in the red zone, and you're like, man. How many times you knew Atlanta was going to score in that situation? It's just been how many times can you be in the red zone without allowing a touchdown? I mean, just eventually the law of averages.
And also,
it's
a quick turnaround for the defense. They're immediately on their heels. Shout out the defense, who had so many short fields to deal with.
God,
never. By the way, the fault of one Cameron Johnston, who had a wonderful game, because I never doubted Cameron. All right, I was one of the few. I'm patting myself on the back like twice one episode here. It's not good. But cameraman had a great night. He's got a boot. I can tell you, man. He can kick that thing. But shout out to the defense dealing with those short fields. I want to ask you about that interception, though, the Dallas Goedert drop. Because I thought, particularly when they gave us that end zone view, that behind the offensive line view, that you see Goedert release into the seam pretty quickly. And you see him turn around for the football. And Foles lets that puppy sit for a little bit and then gets the ball out there while KZ is leaking forward onto that seam route. There's a reason that was the first seam route we had seen all game. It's because it's hard to hit seam routes against Atlanta when they play that single high and they let that kid come up and hit. In my opinion, you know, if Goddard's able to to catch that and secure that. That's a good play by Goddard. But that ball should either be out much quicker or it should not be thrown, because you're basically putting your guy in a defenseless position with a safety coming downhill.
Right.
Which you can say whatever you want about rules changing how safeties hit and what other penalties are.
It's obviously a hospital ball.
Safeties can still... That's what I called it. And I know a few people disagreed with the hospital ball nomenclature. And I think it could have not been a hospital ball if it had gotten out quicker. But under the circumstances, that ball was out late. To me, that was more so on Foles than it was on Goddard. Obviously, again, a secured catch is possible and would have been a good play. But to me, that was Foles' fault. I will say, man, Foles is bad, huh?
Almost, he had almost two interceptions in that one drive. Ben, I was just no peeking. I was just going to ask you. We're going to play this guessing game that we like to do here. What would you guess Nick Foles' yards per attempt were?
4.
Whew. You're generous, because 3.44 yards per attempt.
Is he a running back?
Yeah. If you don't understand yards per attempt, or you don't look at it often, you're forgiven. It's kind of a, you know, more nuanced stat. And I'm not trying to talk down to you or mansplain anything to you, but like normally you're looking at...
Is that legal? I don't think that's legal in the state of Pennsylvania to have less than 3.5 yards per passing attempt.
Yo, Eli Manning without Odell Beckham Jr. last year, what was he, like 5.9 yards per attempt?
Right. And you're talking about 2.5 yards less? I remember we busted out laughing when we read that stat. And we were like, oh, below 6, that sucks.
He could have, dude, he had great turnover luck. I mean, the Goddard thing was whatever, that, you know, you kind of put that pick on him, but at the same time, he didn't throw it at a defender. There were a few times where you're just like, geez, you got it. Maybe don't pass. Maybe get a Jaylen in the first half. We only got 9 snaps in the first half. We had to have that same conversation again of, you know, Ajay is going to get his touches. He's going to come in the second half. Trust the process and all that stuff. But yeah, Foles looked bad and off. And I don't know, man. I guess he did just enough to win the game, because QB wins are a thing. But they really aren't in that situation. Because, yeah, if he's always been better when he can hit that first or second read. And if he has to hold on to the ball a little bit longer than that, that's where he really struggles. And that's always been the case. Even after that Pro Bowl year that he had, the next year, he even came out and said that he was holding on to the ball more, trying to make big plays. And that's where he really suffered. I think he held on to the ball a little bit too much today and just didn't have the accuracy. And the linebackers for the Atlanta Falcons were shredding in coverage underneath until the Falcons got beat up, until Trufant got that knock, and then Jones was cramping up or something like that. But Keanu Neal went out, and then you started to see things open up a little bit more. But until that point, like, I don't know, middle of the third quarter, late in the third quarter, those linebackers had that. How many times did you see either Devondre Campbell, Duke Riley, or Deion Jones with super tight coverage on either Zach Ertz, Nelson Aguilar in the middle of the field, or Dallas Goedert? It was truly impressive.
Oh, no, yeah. I mean, obviously it was something that was highlighted when we came back from the half. It was something that was shown kind of on the replay. Deion Jones, Devondre Campbell. I do take umbrage with the claim that Deion Jones is the best coverage linebacker in the NFL while Nigel Bradham is standing on the opposite sideline. I find that very bold. But regardless, Deion Jones and Devondre Campbell, two of the top mover linebackers. Campbell wearing 59 always throws me off, but he's an excellent athlete despite the fact that he's wearing 59. So yes, those guys are fantastic. And then obviously when you get Duke Riley out on the field there as well, Riley's wonderfully quick in space and can be a good coverage man, especially on running backs. And then when you get Keanu Neal down into the box, Keanu Neal is a wonderful pass defender in that regard. Listen, you saw it. The Eagles have played the Falcons in 3 straight seasons. You saw it, I think, in all 3 seasons. And you've seen it when teams go to play any of these Dan Quinn style defenses in Seattle or in Atlanta. You don't attack the seams. You don't really attack the middle of the field. You have to be able to try to beat those corners in cover 3 situations. And what made the Seattle defense so good was that they had corners who could win in cover 3, right? With the Richard Sherman profile in terms of length and aggressiveness at the line of scrimmage. Robert Alford played a fantastic game, I thought.
Oh,
he had a wonderful game in coverage on the one corner side. Desmond Trufant also, I thought, had a good game. Not a stellar one. Had a couple ticky-tack penalties that probably shouldn't have been called, which you can say about a lot of penalties in this game. But they had good games there on the outside. Obviously, Philadelphia, I don't think, hit a pass that traveled more than like 6 yards in the air that wasn't thrown by Nelson Agholor. You know what I mean? There was the one little zone sit route to Zach Ertz immediately after Philly Special 2.0, which how have we not talked about that yet?
I was going to say, we have to, but go ahead.
You're basically just working the flats. You're working the flats and you're working quick slants if you can hit them, which Atlanta did a great job taking those away. Atlanta, because of the lack of Alshon Jeffrey, had the ability to really roll their corners forward,
right.
Play very aggressively into the line of scrimmage, and then say, hey, Nick, beat us deep with Mike Wallace or with Nelson Agholor up the boundary, and Nick's not able to hit those throws with consistency. And so, yeah, the passing game was incredibly limited for Philadelphia. Not surprised the yards per attempt was so low. What it really came down to, which, you know, goes against everything we've been talking about all offseason, the running game kept them in plus yardage situations, especially in the second half. Obviously, 15 points in the second half versus 3 in the first half. They were able to keep themselves ahead of the sticks with nice rumbling runs from JHI, especially picking up 30 yards after contact, 5 yards on first down, 6 yards on first down, getting themselves into easier third down situations. And then shout out Darren Sproles. Coming back from injury, he had 2 key first down conversions that really stand out in my mind, especially that 3rd and 6 one where he caught the ball with like 5 yards to go and 3 defenders in front of him. And you just kind of knew in your head, like, yeah, Sproles about to pick this up in some sort of stupid way, ain't he? And he did. So shout out to Darren for that. But still, it came down to the backs and the flats. It came down to the quick throws to Nelson Agholor and then picking up as much yak as he could.
Talking about people that are coming back from an injury, that final go-ahead touchdown from Jay Ajayi, where you get Jason Kelce and Jason Peters pulling to the left. And I just, man, Jason Peters, for me, had a fantastic game. I was catching glimpses of him, and like, I don't know if he had a flawless game or not. I wasn't watching that closely, but he had a darn good game. He looked darn healthy.
Had a great game. Shout out to Stephen Wisniewski, who had a pretty good game, despite the fact that he's the liability on the Eagles offense.
According to Andy Benoit, yeah, exactly. Hey, okay, so you were looking up a stat, and I'm waiting to see if you've got it yet. Did you find that stat?
Yeah, so here, well, I'll put it to you this way. There have been a lot more games with less than 3.5 yards per attempt than I ever would have thought. But let me just read you some of the names that have had these games. All right, 2017.
In Nick Foles' company.
2017, Brett Hundley, Nate Peterman, Brett Hundley again, Eli Manning, Sam Bradford, DeShone Kizer. 2016, Blake Bortles, Blaine Gabbert, Drew Stanton. 2015, BJ Daniels. You remember BJ Daniels, Mike?
The lesser of the Daniels.
BJ Daniels. And guess who the other player was in 2015 to have exactly 3.5 yards per attempt? Aaron Rodgers against the 2015 Denver Broncos secondary.
Oh, wow.
A 29-10 loss was held at 3.5 yards per attempt. And then anyway, 2014 gets Kellen Clemens, Andy Dalton, Zach Mettenberger. 2013, Kirk Cousins, Andy Dalton, Michael Vick, Jay Cutler, Brock Osweiler, Blaine Gabbert. Let's safe to
so
say
many names.
This is not company you want to be in. This is dull. This is dull, sad company to be in.
And despite all that, Philly Special, yet again, they pulled it out. The balls, come on, man. Like,
listen, I'm pretty sure I'd have to go because it was at the first half that I checked the stat. I'm pretty sure that was their second longest offensive play of the night.
It was. Yeah.
15 yards. But seriously, how? I forget who it was who tweeted out, but somebody said, yo, if we lose, we still win because we ran the play again. Obviously, a little bit different. We still score. We picked up a first down on it. It's just unbelievable arrogance. It's just pure, undiluted, like, hey, remember that trick play I ran that's now immortalized in history to an unbelievable degree? I'm just going to run pretty much the exact same play on, like, a third down at the 35 because I can. Screw right. You. Signed, Doug Peterson.
Some of the other things that, how ballsy. Some of the other things I wanted to touch on is we talked about some of the deep shots that the Falcons would or would not take. I thought Jim Schwartz was pretty dialed in. They went Yankee, like we talked about in the preview show. And I believe, let's see, that one was on first down. The Eagles saw it coming. They sent McLeod on a blitz on that 1st and 10, and they saw that coming. And that was, what was it, from 1st and 10 on their own 32? No, the 32-yard line one was the 52-yarder that Jalen Mills got bailed out on. So let's talk about this secondary. I thought Ronald Darby played a fantastic game, was much more sound in his technique, looked more comfortable from a back pedal because he doesn't open as early when he's in a shuffle and was able to click and close. Sidney Jones played well. Rasul Douglas came up with the big interception. Jalen Mills played well for most of the game. And then he gets beat on that 52-yarder, which I thought was a catch. I don't know why they didn't rule that as a catch. But another double move, another sluggo, again, for Jalen Mills. My God, man, are we going to have to deal with this all year yet again with these freaking sluggos? And no, it wasn't a sluggo. It was a double move. I'm sorry. It was just a nice little stop and go, but come on.
It's really quite bad because Mills bites on those plays when he's in a good position to defend them.
Right. And he's got a good angle.
Right. It's not as if he's in a bad spot. They give him the stutter. He tries to recover hard on it, and then they beat him. He had great positioning for a potential deep comeback. Like, he would have closed right down, and he would have been over the top, so he would have had to come around the receiver to make a play, like, get his hands into the catch. It's not like he was going to have a pick or something, but he was in great position, and he takes the cheese so hard, and that's not good when you're leaving a guy like that in the deep third. I mean, it's known at this point, right? Like, it's very well known across the league you can get this guy in this way. The long and the short of it, as far as Darby goes, to me, is he looks back to 2015, 2016 quickness, right? Yeah. It's so important to remember with Darby. It's easy to forget. We are off, I believe it was his 2015 was his rookie season.
Then he had a great season then, right? Yeah.
Right. He looked well on the trajectory to be a top 10 corner. 2016, mm-hmm. I believe there was a scheme change, different defense in Buffalo. A little bit shaky, and now all of a sudden with a new regime, he gets traded to Philadelphia. You have the injury, an ankle injury for a corner who gets brought back into the season. That's probably not ever at 100%. A 100% Ronald Darby is so agile, and it's really it's very valuable for an Eagles team that needs that, you know, cornerback one, that true guy. Now, ability to stay connected down the field on Julio wasn't super great. Ability for 99% of NFL corners to stay connected down the field on Julio, not super great. So we're not going to count that against him. He had very positive flash plays, obviously good coverage on that last play. Two pass breakups that come to mind as high-quality plays. Yep. And then Julio beat him downfield a couple times, got open on the little pinch route, on the bench route, on the comeback, stuff that we've talked about. It's really okay. And what you saw, which I really, really liked, was that Schwartz was far more willing in the second half to bring five to force that ball out quicker when Julio's working those deep routes, because they take time. They take a solid 2.5 seconds, the number that we always talk about as when to get the ball out. So if you start bringing five, you at least collapse that pocket a little bit more. You get a little bit more traffic near the feet of a quarterback who clearly looked very skittish around pressure. He was having a bad night. That's where you get balls that are inaccurate going to those isolation routes where it's Darby or Mills one-on-one against Julio. So really nice adjustment by Schwartz in that regard. I mean, Schwartz beat the pants off Sark for the second season in a row. We do not talk enough about Jim Schwartz's in-game adjustments and the changes that he's made. I know it's something I've said in the podcast before, but man, Schwartz has really taken on the mantle of the analytics and the game planning that kind of Howie and Doug champion. Schwartz is right there with him.
So I was watching the Philly special thing last night that they had along with the America's game thing, which was amazing. But they talked about that play in the Super Bowl, the forced fumble by Brandon Graham. And one of the things that they mentioned was that they wanted to put Cox on the right side of the line because they knew they were going to get the center slide that way. And it was going to free Brandon Graham to get a one-on-one against Jack Mason. That's what happened. And then the fumble happened, and that was the key play in that game. In this game, early on in the game, in third down, they put Cox to the right. I think it was the left side or the right side of the formation. Either way, they get that center slide. Right. And then Hicks comes along the right and he's got free one on one with Devonta Freeman. He doesn't have to worry about working through alignment or anything. They knew that they were going to get Hicks through there. They knew when to blitz Ronnie McCloud. They knew when to run blitz him, too. I thought it was a really, really good game plan by Jim Schwartz all around, who I don't ever hear a lot of people give Jim Schwartz a lot of credit. I thought he called a really good game front to back. In this game, just being up against in the red zone alone and only allowing 12 points is a huge accomplishment.
Listen, you mentioned his name adjacently, so I'll just bring it in. Alex Mack, center for the Falcons, is an all-pro player. Yeah. Andy LaVitri, left guard for the Falcons, is a great left guard. Right guard, Brandon Fusco for the Falcons. A player who put together a really good season last season, a free agent addition, wasn't super great with the Niners, had a great last season, now he's here with Atlanta, so kind of unknown there. But he's an NFL starter.
I mean, he beat out Joshua Garnett for that spot when Garnett was the ingrained starter there, yeah.
Now, that's a decent interior, especially Mac, obviously a fantastic player. I don't think Cox was blocked once, man. Listen, there were, like, if the quarterback were just, like, you know, like a pin, like a bowling pin or just, like, a flag or something, and by taking an offensive lineman and putting him in the lap of that pin or knocking over that flag with him count as a sack, Fletch would have 8 sacks a game, all right? I can't express to you, like think, for example, the Chris Long strip sack that was not recovered, but it was on like a 2nd and 15 that made it like a 3rd and 20 or something, right?
It was Cox and Matt Ryan's face, and that's what made him hold on to the ball, and that's what gave Long time to get there.
Chris Long, like, didn't lose the rep, but if you're an offensive tackle and you can push the defensive end that far behind the pocket, like 10 yards behind the original line of scrimmage, it's very irregular that he gets back into the play. It doesn't typically happen. What has to happen for him not to get back in the play is that there can be nowhere to climb up. And Fletcher Cox takes up so much space in the interior. He offers so much to the Eagles' pass rush, especially their edges, that does not get put into the box score because he took a good interior, a good top 12, top 10 interior in the NFL comfortably.
Yeah.
And just violated him snap after snap. Like, oh no, there's no Timmy Jordan again. This will be a problem. Week one, evidentially, it's not going to be too much of an issue.
And not only that, not only is he just like an upfield disruptor that destroys pockets, he's so aware in the screen game when he notices something fishy, and he sniffed out the one to Devonta. I can't imagine being Devonta Freeman and coming out for a screen pass, and you look to see where your space is going to be, and you see Fletcher Cox with no one around him just bearing down on you. That's got to be the most frightening thing in the world. And a lot of credit again to Chris Long, man. He has a nose for the football. And that's the most important thing, like that Wilson, I've heard him preach, and he did so again in the Philly special when they were talking about the Graham thing, but finding the football. Chris Long had 4 forced fumbles last year and then comes in and gets one in the first game, always making a contribution. I love this pass rush. This pass rush is awesome. And you get Fletcher Cox just destroying pockets. It's going to be a gigantic year for him. You could tell, I'm sure you could tell from training camp, but when I got my first whiff of it was that preseason game against the Pittsburgh Steelers, and he just discarded top-tier guard in David DeCastro on the Steelers, and I was like, this dude's about to have a monster season, and it's looking real good for him.
I have 2 final takes. One, I think, on the probably the last positional group we haven't touched yet, and then the other, you mentioned preseason. There's a big, you know, kind of, oh, this game's super sloppy because the players don't play enough in the preseason, and they're not super locked in. I disagree with this take. I'll tell you why. Is because I don't really think the starters care about the preseason at all, which I don't think is a shocking revelation. So I don't think any of their preseason reps, they're going to be 100% mentally and physically engaged. And I think, you know, that's not shocking to anybody. Nobody's running around, flying around, hitting people. Like, you know, the starters trying to take people's heads off in the preseason. Nobody's super locked in, especially the veterans who are starters. They've seen this all before. They know the regular season's coming. You get the more preseason reps, it's just more like 80% reps. That'd be my theory. You know what I mean? This is my belief. It's not super founded, and anything could be totally wrong. Maybe more preseason games help. I don't see that. Take number 2 is, we haven't talked about the linebacking core yet. Kamu-Grugé Hill's good. All right. Yeah. Kamu-Grugé Hill was all over the place. He's great as a Sam. He's great as a Will. He's great as the end man on the line of scrimmage. He's one of the best edge defending linebackers who's not an actual 3-4 outside linebacker I've ever seen. He's fantastic.
He had that stuff on the goal line with Freeman, and other than that, he played real well.
He's a great blitzer off the edge. He can bend the corner really, really well. Why isn't he rushing more well? He's fantastic setting edges in the running game in that regard. He's super physical. He flies to the football. He got great flexibility, which is underreported, underappreciated. He made multiple plays that stood out to me last night. We should feel very good about Bradham, Hicks, Kamu. Nate Gary.
Oh.
No. No.
No.
But Kamu is great.
Yeah, yeah, I didn't think Nate Gary played well at all, and you get him in the, well, what was it, the first drive, the red zone drive, where you get Devonta Freeman in the slot, and Nate Gary is trying to cover him, and then later on, I think it was the next red zone drive, where he had to, what was it, he faked like he was getting picked, or like he hit the tight end on the way to try to get Freeman, because he was so far behind, and they ended up throwing to the tight end. Matt Ryan missed that read, too, because he had Freeman on that wheel.
Matt Ryan missed a bunch of reads in the red zone, but here's the thing, don't ask your quarterback to make reads in the red zone. It's the most crowded short area place ever. By the time he mentally processes what's freaking going on.
It's done.
There's not going to be a window there anymore. Red zone should be pre-snap determined throws, or if you want to make him make a read, allow him to roll out so everything is flowing in one direction. This is my take.
Or same side. Half field, give him at least a 1-2 bang bang read. Like for me, that wasn't what they were setting him up with. Okay, Ben, I'm sure we have to do three word recaps because you put it out there on Twitter. This is something that we're going to be doing after every game. One of us is going to ask for three words from you, gentle listener, on Twitter to describe this game. Benjamin Solak, at Benjamin Solak, put the tweet out this time. Ben, I haven't seen him yet, so I'm actually kind of I'm very excited for this.
Listen, here's the thing. I haven't seen all of them yet either because we used to do this and get like 11, and I've got 72 responses right now. So we're going to read through. I think the main account retweeted us. I'm just going to read through a few of them.
Oh, boy.
Obviously, we should start out with the king. The cult leader, Brandon Lee Gowton, who just hit up Big Balls Doug, which is always a classic. Yeah. And it should be noted, Douglas, man. I mean, you can talk about Philly Special 2.0, but you can talk about that last game-winning drive. He's a fantastic play caller. He has some questionable decisions in this game, as there always is. But all in all, he's wonderful. Also, shout out Betts, friend of the podcast, who his first word was big and his last word was Nick, and the middle word rhymed with Nick. And that was his tweet, which shout out Betts. Gotta love Betts.
By the way, if you haven't heard Fireside Chats with Betts, no, it was on the Kist and Solak show. It was on Kist and Solak show number 4. That
Fireside Chats is not good enough. It's not important enough premium time slot for Betts at all 22.
You're killing me. I have some great conversations on there. I'm scheduling Duke Mannyweather right now of OL Masterminds, Duke. And he's been working with Lane Johnson, so that's going to be fun. But yeah, the RPO Protecting Carson Wentz episode of Kiss and Solak has a fun interview with Betts. Thank you for chiming in, Betts.
All right. At Brandon Ekstrom says that just happened, which, accurate. Tyler Morales at _ Team Morales. Thanks, Steve Sarkisian. Yeah, honestly, game ball, Steve Sarkisian.
I'm so glad he showed how smart I was, by the way. Like I can't take enough credit for myself because I know I'm already doing it a lot, and I'm hoping that you'll help me here. But Steve Sarkisian, shout out to you, buddy. You are the real
MVP. Making
Mike
looking mad smart on the pregame podcast. Got to pull that soundbite. At N10 says never in doubt, and then says do not check my timeline for proof, which I think is pretty funny. I like somebody asked Barnett a bust ? Which is unnecessary. At Major Shock says, Jesus, almost unwatchable. Another one that made me laugh. Somebody said Sullivan's last game at that deal Hilton, which is pretty funny.
Oh, yeah. DeAndre Hall, who we traded a 7th round pick for, was watching that play and going, and he's on a 1-game suspension. And he was watching that safety we got from the Bears going, how about that? That's interesting. Because, look, I watched some DeAndre Hall tape. I put an article on him on bleedinggreennation.com. I think he's good. I think he can fill that 4th spot fantastically. So we'll see how that plays out. But it doesn't look good for old Trey.
At Connorable Mention says too many flags, which honestly is pretty true. At Buffalo Bernie, is this life? Which, here we are, man. Welcome to the 2018 NFL season. At BT Rossler, friend of the podcast, Bryce. Says Collinsworth talks RPOs, which I really like because it sounds like this actual episode of like a talk show, which basically that was. At Boris Dirk's been giving us three words for a long time.
Yeah,
says wait and hope, which I don't know about you, Boris, but I'm gonna go to sleep and not hope. That's what I'm gonna do.
I'm gonna edit this podcast and pull my sound bites from the last episode that we did because I'm smart about red zone offense.
Oh, at TS Howland. Says, I looked, but has no one done, quote, Ben was wrong, which pretty sure we both picked against the Eagles. Apparently, I'm the one getting exposed for it.
I knew we were going to broach this topic, and it's important, Ben. So we might want to put away those three-word things because we need to talk about how Ben was wrong. And Mike's reverse jinx has worked again because we both picked the Falcons to win this game. In a low-scoring game, we both picked the under. We were both right on that, right? But yes. Ben just outright picked the Falcons to win. I had a clear motivation for mine that was beneficial to the team as a whole. The reverse jinx always works. That's all we need to say about that. So
I was waiting because I was just going to do like the Skype hang up sound once you were done with that. That was pretty funny. Last one for three words. My favorite one. Completely inexplicable. Could not tell you what it's about. at Josh CRM Mita, who's been doing this for us for a while, says horseshoe in bung.
All right. Something about horseshoes and being lucky and close enough. I don't know where that's going.
Horseshoe in bung. Josh, hit me up and explain to me this very peculiar idiom, horseshoe in bung.
I'll ask him in the, he's a scouting academy guy. I'm going to chat with him. I'll ask him what the heck that means. We'll figure it out. So that's been three words recap this game.
A beautiful inaugural episode of three words. A lot of content. Yeah.
So again, Eagles pull out the season opener, their defense of their title, 18-12 against the Atlanta Falcons. Next up here on Bleeding Green Nation, me and Ben are going to watch the film. I've got a lot of charting to do. I'm sure Bennett's going to do the same type of thing. We're going to beat this up and tear this down and look at it from even nerdier angles than you could ever imagine, because the season is finally here and we finally get to really go to work. So that's going to be fun. So we're going to be doing another All 22 film work show about this, and we'll get you updated on all the injuries and whatnot. Also, I'm setting up some fireside chats, and we've got some other type content coming for you as we roll in through this long week. I've also talked with Trevor Sikkema of Pewter Report and Locked On NFL Draft. He's going to come on and preview the Tampa Bay Buccaneers versus the Philadelphia Eagles. Trevor's a great dude, man. I got to party with him in Mobile. I talk with him all the time on Twitter. He's awesome. He's great on Locked On NFL Draft. You're really going to enjoy him. We're going to have other guests like that. It's very important to us to bring on guests with different viewpoints so we don't just end up like an echo chamber. We want to talk with the experts about these teams that we're going up against so we can get a full understanding of what we're dealing with. Obviously, they have a game to play. There's a whole Sunday of football that you get to enjoy without having to stress out about your Eagles. They're 1-0. Ben, you got anything else for the gentle listeners?
My last gift on this podcast to you is just go on Twitter and search Eagles Jim Schwartz throws headset. This is a wonderful clip of after the Derby, you know, the game winning, the game sealing play of Jim Schwartz just very fabulously chucking his helmet or his headset in excitement. It's very, very, very sassy. Do you see that?
Look
at the follow through with the hand up here.
That was like a golf swing. He's like, and my job is done.
Yeah. Man, you can tell that he was pretty, pretty, pretty done with this game like we all were. As always, this has been the Kissed and Solak show here at Bleeding Green Nation Radio. I've been Benjamin Solak on Twitter at Benjamin Solak. That's S-O-L-A-K. He's been Michael Kist on Twitter at Michael Kist NFL. That's K-I-S-T. He's still doing the Jim Schwartz headset throw in the camera as we speak. What a game, folks. Welcome to the 2018 season. I'm so much less excited about it now than I was like 48 hours ago. But that was a good one. 1-0. Eagles well on their way back to Super Bowl 53. Thank you so much for listening. We'll get back to you guys next week.
It's a big win, and it might have playoff implications down the line, so I'm glad we won that
freaking
game. It's
better, man. If we suffered through it. It better mean something.
Oh, it better. We all we got. It's been a long night. We all we got. We all we need. Fly, Eagles, fly. Whew. Oh, you're going to hit him with a caca? You see that one?
Oh, right.
That one?
He requested it. It feels very inorganic now, but I'll still do it. It's been a while.
Oh.
Caca!
We'll work. That was pretty good. I like the
way
you
decided. Yeah, I know. Well, I wanted to kind of try to sound like a dying falcon.
Hey, I'm Anil Dash, and I'm the host of a new show called Function from the Vox Media Podcast Network and Glitch. This season, we're talking with experts about why our voting machines are so bad and how that might hurt our elections. We'll also talk with an animator to find out how popular dances from the real world end up in video games. And we're going to tackle the biggest question in tech. Why do so many celebrities use screenshots from that Apple Notes app to make their public apologies when they screw up? You can find new episodes of Function every Monday on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And thanks to Microsoft Azure for sponsoring Function.